Didn't get a chance to go a little more deeper into what you're saying, but appreciate it. And sorry to those people who did call in and weren't able to get on the air. Appreciate everybody who called in. This is a conversation that needs to continue. Go down to the inner southeast Portland, check out what's going on with these homeless sweeps, and bring a camera, video camera. And that's all I got to say. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Coming up, David Barsamian.
Kind of nervous. As I rise up from her arms, she says, I guess you call this love, I call it service. Why don't you come on back to the war? Don't be a tourist. Why don't you come on back to the war before it hurts us? Why don't you come on back to the war? Let's all get nervous. You cannot stand what I become. You much prefer the gentleman.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Student Debtors Assembly. Thursday, May 28th, 2 p.m. in the Park Block at Southwest Harrison in Portland. A debtors assembly is a public forum to talk about debt, to dispel stigmas, myths, and taboos about debt, to learn about debt, and to organize to change the state of debt in our lives. There will be presentations from organizers, academics, debtors, artists, and musicians, and there will be opportunities for everyone to share openly about their debt and how it affects their lives. Again, that's the Student Debtors Assembly, Thursday, May 28th at 2 p.m. on the PSU Park Block near Southwest Harrison. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under community events.
Hello, KBOO members. You are invited to attend KBOO's Mission and Vision Retreat on May the 30th from noon to 4 p.m. This retreat is an opportunity for members to support the development of a mission and vision statement for KBOO and to share your valuable knowledge about your community radio station. If you would like to attend the retreat on May the 30th, get in touch with Monica Beamer and RSVP by sending her an email at monica@kboo.org or calling 503-231-8032, extension 201. More details about the agenda for the retreat will be sent to you when you RSVP. We hope to see you on May the 30th, and thank you for being an active member of KBOO.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is just 2 minutes after 9 o'clock. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, journalist and author David Barsamian, host and founder of Alternative Radio, speaks on capitalism and the environment, Collision Course. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Air Cascadia is off for the rest of the week. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter presents a recent talk by writer and visionary Susan Griffin on the shifts in Western culture needed for addressing climate change. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent spring membership drive. If you missed it, you can still become a member or renew by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now, investigative journalist David Barsamian, who is a longtime contributor to the independent media landscape, both with his weekly radio show, Alternative Radio, now in its 29th year, and his books with Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Edward Said, and others. His latest book of interviews with Noam Chomsky is Power Systems, Conversations on Global Democratic Uprisings and the New Challenges to U.S. Empire. He spoke at the Clinton Street Theater at a benefit for KBOO on March 4th.
I think it's so important to support community radio stations, and KBOO, with all its faults, with all its problems, is still one of the best community radio stations in the United States. Brothers and sisters, I'm not pulling your leg. You can go to liberal cities like Boston or Baltimore or Philadelphia or Miami, other huge metropoli around the country, and they don't have community radio stations that give their eye teeth for something like KBOO. So your support is absolutely critical for sustaining this independent voice, this island of audio independence in a sea, in an ocean of corporate muck that passes as the media in the United States today. And speaking of the media, a wonderful topic, you can see there's a T-shirt here. It says, "Don't trust the corporate media." It's from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, our friends in New York. But actually, I tend to disagree with this because you can trust the corporate media. To do what? To lie, to fabricate, to invent, to distort, and to induce a kind of comatose situation in the population. So they do have a societal function to support the existing system of power and privilege. That's what they're dedicated. That's what they do, in fact, fairly effectively. And again, KBOO Community Radio is one of those serums that combat this toxicity that's injected throughout the country. I think of our dear friend Howard Zinn, who said, "Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can transform the world." And indeed, as Margaret Mead also said, it's always been small groups of people that have changed things, that have been the engine for progress. And, you know, we've seen that over and over again throughout history. I mean, just take a couple of examples. I know I'm from the left, so I should be full of gloom and doom, right? But, you know, think of some of the really positive things that have happened just in the last few weeks with the defeat of the Keystone XL pipeline, at least vetoed by Obama. The preservation of net neutrality, which is an enormous affirmation for democracy, for keeping the internet privilege free, so the high rollers can't, you know, ride on their, you know, special lanes to get, you know, quick access. These movements that roll these things back, you know, they started with a handful of people. No one thought that Keystone could be stopped. But there was a tremendous grassroots effort around the country on the net neutrality issue. I understand that the FCC received over 4 million communications from people around the country demanding that net neutrality be preserved. So for those who say, you know, it doesn't matter or you can't make a difference, it does make a difference. There's a wonderful group in Canada of First Nations people. That's what they call Native Americans in Canada, First Nations. Idle No More, largely started by women and women-driven in Manitoba, I believe, in Winnipeg a few years ago. And they have done tremendous work in Canada on these issues of mineral extraction and the tar sands in northern Alberta. I know we all have it. When you hear the word Canada, you probably think hockey, and you get a warm, fuzzy feeling. Maybe those of you old enough to remember Sergeant Preston in the Yukon. You know, a couple people here might remember that. Right. Onward King. Onward Huskies. But, you know, I've been going to Canada quite a bit in recent years, and I've learned that this, you know, this country with a population smaller than the state of California, 75% of the major mining corporations in the world are headquartered in Canada. Canada is running amok on this planet, and wherever they are going, be it in Mexico, in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa and Papua New Guinea, their extractive industries, I mean, they're going after copper and tin and oil and manganese and bauxite, etc. There are massive human rights violations going along with that, which is part and parcel for the course of extractive industries. I want to bring you greetings from the Denver International Scareport, where I was this morning, watching the TSA. You know what TSA means? Thousands standing around. I'm not kidding you. There were all of these officers in blue with literally nothing to do. This has now mushroomed into a huge bureaucracy of over $7 billion and with 60,000 employees and growing exponentially. And this has happened to me a number of times. I don't know, is it because of my very intimidating stature and enormous height? Perhaps. But I keep getting pulled over, even though I go through their magical mystery machines and do this and everything out of your pocket. And yes, everything's out of my pocket. Go back into the machine. Okay, go back into the machine. Hands up again. Come out. Oh, we're going to have to pat you down now. I said, this is ridiculous. And the guy said, what's ridiculous? I just went through your million-dollar machine twice. Oh, there's something underneath your shirt. So I said, I lifted up my shirt and I said, yeah, this, my nipple. That's what your machine is showing. Thanks a lot. Have a nice day. So I composed in the spirit of Howard Zinn a little ditty called Ode to Scareports. Hey, hey, TSA, how many people have you pulled over today? Who have you frisked and in what way? Lies, 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 fill up agency files. UAVs rain death from the skies. Pilotless drones will blow out your eyes. Liberties, schliberties, the Bill of Rights have taken flight. Be full of fright. Spy, spy, into the night you'll fly. Government agents, look out! Here comes the FBI. IEDs, RPGs, WMDs, DHS, CIA, NSC, DIA, NSA. There goes the USA. There goes the USA. Years ago, Canada's great singer-poet Leonard Cohen wrote a song called Democracy is Coming to the USA. I think if he were rewriting it today, he would put a question mark at the end of that, because we have seen a steady erosion of democracy here in the United States. And as the great Michael Parenti has commented, the real danger we face is not from terrorism, but what is being done under the pretext of terrorism. That wasn't an applause line. It's all right, but you can applaud. And speaking of applause, I bet you there's several people here who remember a class in school called penmanship. Raise your, no. Okay, one person. It was an old art of writing clearly. Now, why would I say something like that in front of such an erudite audience? Well, what happens on these speaking tours, I hand these sign-up sheets out, and when they're returned, I can't read 9/10 of the scribbles. So please, if you'd like to get on the alternative radio mailing list, just your name and your email address written clearly. And rest assured, I'm not going to share this with the NSA because they already have all your information. So don't worry about that. Now, one of the things, I am going to get to the topic tonight, which is about capitalism versus the environment, a collision course, but there's a lot to say, and I'll try and say it very quickly. This is also, this year, in fact, April 24th, marks the centenary of the genocide of the Armenians by the Turks. This is something that, of course, speaks to me and my family and my being here in this country for what happened in Turkey in 1915. So I was asked to write a little piece for the Kronos Quartet, which may or may not be performed later this year at Lincoln Center and in other venues. It's an answer to the question, why do I feel it is important to talk about the Armenian genocide 100 years later? And I think because there are probably not many Armenian speakers in the audience, is that a safe assumption? A few, but not many. So I'll translate a couple of the things as they come up. It's important to complete the poems and eat the last pieces of lavash. Lavash is flattened bread. Our grandparents are singing. Let's finish their songs. The lost child of Mush and Bitlis, these are two Armenian towns, cry out, Meirig, Meirig, Ures, Meirig, Menagem, Gevachnam. Mother, mother, where are you? I am alone and afraid. Those who control the past control the present. Those who control the past control the future, Orwell. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. The struggle, Santayana, the struggle of humankind against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. The assassination of Allende quickly covered over the memory of the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia. The bloody massacre in Bangladesh caused Allende to be forgotten. The din of war in the Sinai drowned out the groans of Bangladesh. The massacres in Cambodia caused the Sinai to be forgotten. And so on, until everyone has completely forgotten everything. Milan Kundera. Who speaks today of the annihilation of the Armenians? Adolf Hitler. Yergir, Armenian for homeland, country. Water so clean, air so pure, fruits and vegetables so tasty. So survivors of the genocide told me, maybe with some exaggeration. Yergir, a magical place full of wonder and cruelties. Turkey, a crime scene. No more Enver and Talat statues and streets. Enver and Talat were the two architects, the Jeune Turc, that carried out the genocide of the Armenians. And today, there are buildings and streets and boulevards and schools named after these genocidists. Imagine the uproar in this country if there were a Himmler Boulevard in Germany somewhere, or a Goebbels building ministry and things like that. Well, that's, you know, that's going on even today in Turkey. The U.S. ambassador at the time was Hans Morgenthau, who's actually Barbara Tuchman's grandfather, I believe, the great historian. He interviewed, when he heard the stories that his consuls were sending in from other parts of Turkey that were coming into the capital, which was then called Constantinople, Istanbul today, he was very agitated, and he went to see Talat, who was the main, one of the two, as I just said, architects of the genocide. And he wanted to know, where are these deportation caravans heading? And Talat told him, their destination is the abyss. The death march. The ground was so hot, my feet were burning, Sarkis Hagopian told me. We were so hungry, we ate unripened fruit. We were so thirsty, we wet our lips with horse's urine, my mother Araxi told me. We, the keepers of memories and dreams, keep coming up like weeds to remind you and ourselves of the past, a failed, a faded, but dear landscape drenched in blood, the burning of books and churches. We live in their ashes. Our response to the ruins of that world, the creative act. Let us play again in our gardens and fields and glory in the beauty of flowers forever. Bari Janapar, safe travels. Shinara Galem, thank you. And I recently discovered this essay from Kenneth Rexroth, where I pulled that our response to the ruins of the world. What is that? What should that response be? More despair? More, surrender? More depression? I don't think that's the proper response. For our own spiritual well-being, we need creative acts. We need to have poems and films and discussions and books and novels in order to sustain ourselves in a creative way. That seems to me to be a proper response to the ruins of the world. And as we look around now with the devastation, I mean, the multiple wars in the Middle East, the Nobel Peace Prize winning constitutional lawyer President Barack Obama bombing, shall I roll off the countries, or you know them all by heart? Somalia, Pakistan, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Mali. There's one country after another. The permanent war on terror, First of all, such a preposterous notion. How can you have a war on a tactic? You know, it's think about it for a second. It's like having a war on jealousy or a war on envy or a war on greed. But nevertheless, this term persists. And of course, it's always about the terror coming from them, not the terror that we are responsible for and that our allies are responsible for. That, our friends at National Public Radio or National Propaganda Radio and PBS, the Petroleum Broadcasting Service, they cannot address those questions because they embed all of the assumptions of empire. They embed all of the assumptions of imperialism, of the right to the U.S. to intervene anywhere in the world. They embed all of the assumptions about capitalism. Well, it needs to be maybe tweaked a little bit and, you know, a little, cosmetics here, a little lipstick there, a little rouge there, and, you know, there's nothing like a good old capitalism. Well, there's a war on the earth that's going on right now. There's a war on nature, and that war is being carried out by the capitalist economic system. And it's inexorable, it's a juggernaut, and unless we identify the problem properly and correctly, we are going to be in the dark, and all of the solutions that we propose, if we've misidentified the problem, what is causing the environment, the eco-crisis, and the war on nature, the war on Pachamama, the war on Mother Earth, we have to identify it as this economic system which is dedicated to one thing only, and that is profits. Everything else you hear about, well, we care about our society, we care about our, you know, our communities and this and that, and we'll write a check and we'll help you out. That's all propaganda. They are institutionally, genetically encoded to do one thing, to make money. And so no matter what my predilections may be, whether I'm, you know, a green person or this type of person or, you know, or an earth firster, if I'm the head of a corporation, of a CEO, of, you know, of Halliburton or ExxonMobil, which last year made the highest profit of any corporation in the history of capitalism, is it by accident that last year, 2014, was also the hottest year since records have been kept globally? Maybe it's just a coincidence. Those records started in 1880. In fact, 7 of the last 10 years have constituted the hottest in history. So it's hard to ignore the evidence. Nevertheless, there is a persistent tone in much of the reporting, particularly in faux news and, you know, CNN and the cable news networks, which, you know, are not really, they're really practicing prostitution. This is not, these are, you know, gas bags, lapdogs with laptops and, you know, overpaid gas bags who are just like nodding away, inviting this or that apologist from corporate America or from the administration, either present officials of the administration or previously part of some kind of administration. Yeah, we do get a range of opinion in the media. Let's salute them for what they do. It's from A to B. It's not from A to Z, which is what we need for a democracy to thrive. As Jefferson said, information is the essence of democracy. If that information is severely limited, it's difficult for people to figure out what's going on. And then, you know, they can be swamped with, you know, Real Housewives and Desperate Housewives and reality TV and, you know, the latest Kardashian wedding or divorce or whatever's happening with their bodies at any particular moment. So we have a serious problem here of WMDs. Yes, we have WMDs right here in our United States, weapons of mass distraction. The corporate media are deflecting people's attention from what's actually going on. And, you know, because of the celebrity-itis, you know, look at the coverage of sports and, you know, Hollywood divorces and all of these things that take people's attention away from what is going on. Again, let me circle back to KBOO. That's why KBOO provides, a tonic to all this toxicity. It does provide really relief from the poisons that are being injected into the atmosphere on a constant basis. Now, I did say, you know, we have to mix some positive news as well. Well, let me just read you a couple of things here. Today, everything comes under the laws of competition and survival of the fittest, where the powerful feed upon the powerless. As a consequence, masses of people find themselves excluded and marginalized, without work, without possibilities, without any means of escape. The idea that a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice in the world has never, never been confirmed by the facts. Now, what radical Marxist said this? Engels, Antonio Gramsci, Pope Francis. The Pope is, yeah. Let's hear it for the Pope. Today's economic mechanisms promote inordinate consumption, yet it is evident that unbridled consumerism combined with inequality proves doubly damaging to society. Inequality eventually engenders a violence which recourse to arms cannot and never will be able to resolve. I'm glad the Pope is on our side. I mean, we've had a series of pretty monstrous representatives in the Vatican over the decades. I'm thinking of the much, you know, venerated Pope John II, who unleashed a war on liberation theology in Central America in the 1980s when he dispatched his gunman, who later became a pope himself, Benedict, to expel, to banish all of those progressive priests. I mean, they didn't liquidate them, but they sent them so far away from any kind of major center that, you know, their impact on society was greatly muted. So we should remember that. We should also talk about, you know, I think this great thing that's happened with, in terms of the media, a couple of really positive things, the continued success of Democracy Now, and I dare say. And, if I may say, alternative radio, which is on almost 200 stations. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO. And other things that have happened, I think, that are really important is The Intercept, which may have some unusual funding, let me just put it that way. But nevertheless, the founder of Intercept, Pierre Omidyar, has given a bundle of cash, like $250 million, which is not chump change. I know it's a little less than KBOO's, you know, annual budget, but nevertheless, a significant amount of money to do investigative reporting. And they've hired Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, Laura Poitras, Murtaza Hussein, and other, you know, outstanding journalists. So, you know, when people ask me, well, what about the future of journalism? You know, when I see these younger voices out there working and producing and doing articles and making documentary films, I'm very encouraged about the future of journalism. It cannot be mediated through ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and CNN. We've got to do end runs around those corporations, and that's what alternative radio is doing, which is soon to be 30 years old, and Democracy Now, and all of these, Making Contact, another two of the engines of Making Contact, are in the audience tonight. Very dear friends of mine, Peggy and John Law. This is a, you know, terrific half-hour program produced in the San Francisco Bay Area, entirely citizen-powered, volunteer-driven, largely. So there are many of these stories that are going on, and new websites springing up, and blogs, etc. We need to encourage that new media. We need to create new media. I don't even talk about Fox News, but I mean, it's like, what's there to say? I mean, Really, I mean, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. I don't feel any kind of intellectual gratification by denouncing the corporate media. I mean, they're just asking for it. I mean, look how they lie shamelessly. I mean, it's really embarrassing. You know, I think, you know, we should actually talk more about the elite media, the agenda-setting media, as Chomsky calls them, the Washington Post, the New York Times, NPR, and it's, you know, Some Things Considered, and some. And don't forget Morning Edition, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. You know, where you hear, like just in the last couple of days, program after program about Netanyahu's visit to the United States and what a great threat, you know, Iran poses, not just to Israel, not just to the Middle East, but the entire world. It's the second coming of the Third Reich. I mean, I'm sure none of you are going to go home tonight and feel safe because there'll be an Iranian under your bed ready to attack you. I mean, that's the kind of hysteria that has been whipped up. I haven't seen every single program on Netanyahu's visit, or I haven't heard every single radio program or read every single article. But how many? I don't recall a single one that has mentioned that there is a nuclear armed state in the Middle East, and that state is Israel. Right. Hello, breaking news. Might this create to instability? Might this cause other states to feel a little bit uneasy? It's remarkable what is omitted rather than what is committed. Most of the sins of the corporate media are omission. They just don't give you the information. So crucial things like that, or other great democracies that, you know, the U.S. supports, such as India, a country which has again denied me a visa to travel to. Why? India has, you know, many nuclear weapons. It also has ballistic missiles. Neighboring Pakistan, the same thing. These are all U.S. Allies, more or less. I mean, Pakistan is a U.S. ally the way Saudi Arabia is a U.S. ally. I mean, you just want to tremble when, you know, they walk into the room. I mean, which side are they on, really? But, you know, nevertheless, those three countries I just mentioned, Israel, India, and Pakistan, are not even signatories to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. They're not being held to account. They're not being subjected to the most, as Obama proudly boasted, the most punitive sanctions in history. Why not? Because if you're on the side of the master, if you serve him or her, then you get a permanent get-out-of-jail pass. You have absolute privilege to do anything you like. That's the imperialism that cannot be discussed. That's the kind of political and military alliances that the United States has been engaging in, quite frankly, since the end of World War II, since 1945, when the U.S. becomes the global behemoth, when it becomes the global hegemon. So this issue of the media, corporate control of the media, has got to, you know, be addressed, and it is being addressed. I mean, one thing that's another very positive thing, young people in droves have abandoned legacy media. And I think that's a good thing. They're not looking at, you know, Martha Raddatz reporting from the Pentagon, interviewing some, you know, five-star general, or, you know, some other reporter, Christiane Amanpour on CNN. And you know all of them. They're not going there. They know what's happening, and that's why they go to The Intercept. They go to Jazeera America, which I think might be available here in the Portland area. People saying yes. I mean, it's just come to Colorado, and it's substantially better than anything else, particularly on Middle East reporting, because they do give you, they fill in those missing gaps, you know, like, well, Israel has had a history with Lebanon. It's invaded Lebanon five times since 1978. It routinely bombs Lebanon. The last time I was in Lebanon, you could hear Israeli drones flying overhead all the time. So there's a history there that needs to be recounted. That information needs to be commonly understood, so we can try to figure out what's going on. Why is this area of the world, I'm asking in a rhetorical way, you know, which has enormous resources that the U.S. has long coveted, oil in particular, why is it racked with violence? From Libya to Egypt, where there was, in fact, a democratic revolution, and then a democratically elected government that was overthrown in a military coup, which John Kerry called restoring democracy. It's astonishing. I mean, the verbal gymnastics these guys go through are quite amazing. I mean, they just have no memory, or since we live in the United States of amnesia, there is no memory. As Kundera said in that poem he wrote, you know, this massacre wiped out the memory of that war. That war wiped out the memory of this genocide. Until at the end, there's no memory whatsoever. So in Egypt, it's run by a military junta. And of course, Kerry's going there every other week, selling more and more arms to Saudi Arabia, our great democratic ally, wonderful, humanistic, pro-feminist, of course, regime. Again, with more friends like Saudi Arabia, who needs enemies? Yeah, not too many. Don't forget, a lot of the turmoil in South and West Asia can be laid right at the door of Saudi Arabia, because they funded the Afghan Mujahideen with U.S. prodding in the 1980s. This gave birth to, you know, the freedom fighters that Reagan talked about, and the moral equivalent of the founding fathers, as he described these drug lords and warlords and misogynists and patriarchs and homicidal maniacs. That's who they were. Invited to the White House, sitting with Ronald Reagan and John Poindexter and other high administration officials, and being accorded that kind of dignified reception. These are the same guys and their allies, Haqqani, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, and others, who are now, you know, the Taliban, the Pakistan Taliban. There was no Pakistani Taliban before the 1970s, before the Afghan war intervention started. The U.S., you know, largely bankrolled. Saudi Arabia sent the money. The U.S. sent the arms. The arms were then given to the Mujahideen, the Afghan so-called freedom fighters. They were trained by the Pakistani army and the ISI. And just go down the road, a lot of the fighters today are, if not the same people, are the sons or nephews or brothers or cousins of those who were fighting in the 1980s. So, you know, what goes around comes around. And we are reaping that bitter fruit today. And sadly, the people in the region are reaping it, which is racked with violence in Syria and Iraq, country after country. And we have to say that the main cause of the destabilization was the criminal invasion of Iraq by the U.S. and U.K. in 2003, one of the most unambiguous war crimes in modern history. And that's where Iraq and Syria begin to unravel. When you hit an already fragile state with a sledgehammer, there are enormous consequences. And people who have guns then come to the forefront and are able to seize power. So we have to make those connections. Now, speaking of the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex, of course, it is the Pentagon. And again, you know, we're number one. We spend more money than the next 10 nations combined on weapons, 6 times more than China. You know, after Iran, you'll be afraid of China next. You know, they're looming in the background. But maybe, you know, Putin and Russia right now are staging a comeback. But ultimately, long range, the U.S. planners see China as their main enemy. And that's why they're building up new bases all over Asia, you know, surrounding China the way we surrounded the Soviet Union during that whole containment policy in the 1940s and 50s. The Pentagon is the largest single polluter in the world. So not only would we, you know, satisfy our peaceful objectives by demilitarizing the United States and pulling back from the hundreds and hundreds. I mean, I can't believe this, but a recent figure I saw says that there are over 5,000 installations, I don't know what that means exactly, that the Pentagon has around the world. I mean, many of them are just depots or warehouses where, you know, munitions and weapons are stored. But still, that's it's an astonishing figure when you think about this little factoid. 500,000 public school teachers have been laid off in the United States in the last 6 years. In Boulder, Colorado, where I live, you know, liberal, progressive, fairly affluent, you know, schools have been consolidated. Teachers are teaching larger classes. There's less and less money for education, hence the push toward privatization. I was just in Fresno a couple of weeks ago, and a teacher there told me, because she's one of these that are getting larger and larger classes, her salary's not increasing. Those are flat in California, and she told me her greatest fear is going to a public place and seeing or meeting one of her students and not knowing who that student is, not knowing that student's name, because the classes have become so large. So there's plenty of money for the imperial war machine, for the military-industrial complex. But there's no money for education. There's no money, little money for healthcare. And crucially, there's very little money to preserve Mother Earth, to protect our precious blue dot in the universe, as Carl Sagan called the Earth. This goes back to, let me read you this. Human beings in the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future that we wish for human society and the plant and animal kingdoms, and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent if we are to avoid the collision our present course will bring about. Now, this is not breaking news. I think what's interesting is when this statement was made. 1992. 1,670 of the preeminent scientists in the world, including 104 Nobel laureates, issued this warning to humanity. And what has happened since then? Or what has happened since James Hansen, the NASA scientist who resigned fairly recently so that he can be more active and speak out, told a congressional committee in 1988 that something's happening with the climate? There's some major change going on. It looks like there's a trajectory, a trend toward warmer, higher and higher temperatures. If that holds, there's going to be, you know, huge consequences down the road. What was the response? A few yawns here and there, and the question disappeared. We've had conference after conference around the world. Name them, Rio, I mean, it's going to be in Paris next year, Copenhagen, Durban, where else? Bangkok, Kyoto. What have these conferences accomplished in real terms? Well, great opportunities for grandiose press releases and photo ops, you know, our great leaders around the world, you know, circling about, pledging, I'm green. No, I'm greener than you are. We are eco-friendly. And then it's, you know, they go home and it's business as usual. Nothing has changed because the system remains the same. We have to change the capitalist economic system, which is, genetically encoded to extract, to maximize gain. That is the crucial issue. So you can have wonderful things going on in countries like Bhutan. What's the population of Bhutan? 700,000, 800,000, you know, this tiny Himalayan kingdom, but with a very enlightened a ruler who wants to lower the carbon footprint. He's even made it more difficult for tourists to visit Bhutan because tourism also generates a lot of pollution, as it were. But that's not going to solve the problem. We need to address this collectively. And that's the key word. Collective action is possible. And this system, the capitalist system that I'm talking about, is really ingenious at seducing the population and giving us, these placebos that, and I confess I do some of them myself, to make us feel good, So, drive a Prius or drive an electric car or, bike to work or, recycle your glass and car and cardboard and paper and plastic and this and that. But that's not sufficient. It is just infinitesimal. Yes, it does feel good, but you shouldn't then think, oh, this is it. This is as far as we go. We need radical action, and I mean that in the best sense of that word, going to the root of a problem. And the problem is the system itself, not dealing and not just having these kind of cosmetic quick fixes. Yeah, and the Guardian newspaper, I should say, the Guardian is one of the best newspapers in the world, has been consistently writing about these issues, talking about George Monbiot, for example, one of their columnists, but, and others as well. Humans eating away at life on Earth. Rate of environmental degradation revealed by two major studies. These come out with such regularity. I mean, you have to have, a major head in the mud not to see these kinds of things. But why isn't the information becoming urgent? Because that's, time is not on our side. For those of you, I know this argument is made, if you have children or grandchildren, what if you don't? It doesn't matter. If you're human, if you care about the future of this Earth, of this planet, of this magical place, we have to act now and we have to do it with an enormous sense of urgency. It's very difficult to have a sustained campaign on this issue because there's so many distractions. There's so many other issues that are coming up and horrible beheadings in the Middle East or horrible, things happening in Gaza and assaults in Libya and, the blowing up of ships here and there and planes being shot out of the sky in the Ukraine and the threat of war in the Ukraine, etc. But the overriding issue, I think, has got to be the collision course that we are on. This economic system versus nature, versus the environment, versus ourselves, our home. That's what we're talking about. Our home is at risk. And what are we going to do? We need to act on this issue. And, I'd love to hear from you in the Q&A about what's happening here in the Portland area around ameliorating the eco-crisis. Because, again, I think it's the absolute crucial issue. A couple of program notes. I did bring copies of my latest book. I have to do this kind of thing because actually, Cable could not pay my $100,000 speaking fee. I know this comes as a shock to you. You are shocked. I mean, I'm stunned. I thought it was all settled, but apparently not. So I have to hustle up some of my books here. The latest one with Chomsky is called Power Systems. It's the best one. It's the hardcover British edition. It's £15. It's like, so it's right there. There's a new book also from on ISIS, if you're interested in that. But I think the bargain tonight are 4 one-hour CDs, 80 minutes of Chomsky just recorded. I interviewed him at Harvard, called Living Memory, unplugged, unedited. Angela Davis, wonderful program recorded in Istanbul, Turkey, on transnational solidarities. Again, a theme of that, solidarity. Solidarity with people struggling elsewhere is absolutely crucial. The wonderful Vandana Shiva of India, Radical Compassion, a very inspirational program. She's a terrific orator. I know many of you know her work here on the West Coast, where she has spoken numerous times. She's a dynamic, articulate speaker who's done just tremendous work on issues of corporate agriculture and the patenting of seeds and GMOs and the dangers threatening agriculture, which has a lot to do also with the water supply. Again, I was just in the Central Valley of California. There are towns now that in some of those areas that have no water. No running water or limited hours of fresh water. This is the breadbasket of the United States, one of the richest agricultural areas in the world. It is in drought. Colorado, my home state, is in drought. The entire Southwest, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, also in drought. Water is I know it's hard for you here in Oregon with, you know, all this lushness and the mountains and the rain. You're in drought, too. Amazing. Well, others, you know, there was I don't like to quote the World Bank very often, but there was you know how wrong they get things, but a couple of years ago, there was this Egyptian vice president of the World Bank who said, in the future, in the 21st century, he was talking in the late 90s, the wars are going to be around water. The conflicts are going to be around water. He said in the past, you know, it was about gold and ivory and, you know, those kinds of things and, of course, oil. But in the future, it's going to be around water. That is connected to the major topic of climate change. With rising temperatures, faster evaporation, you know, weather patterns are being disrupted, less rain in some places, more rain in others. This is a very, very, you know, important issue, thinking about water. And finally, the fourth program is with Cornel West, Love and Justice. You know he's also one of these fabulous orators who not just inspires, but also delivers the good. There's content there, not just rhetoric. So let me just close with maybe reading you a poem, actually written on the title of the poem is September 1st, 1939. Does that ring a bell here with anyone? The beginning of World War II, the German invasion of Poland. And Auden was in New York at the time. He wrote this poem. He had been in Spain as an ambulance driver with the loyalists against the Nazi and Mussolini-supported fascists of Franco in the Spanish Civil War. All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of Eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. Again, to track back to Rex Roth, so important to be positive, to have alternatives, to have answers to questions. I don't know if I read this the last time I was in Portland, but I'm going to hope that many of you have forgotten it. But it's by the greatest Urdu poet of the 20th century. Again, I know the audience is full of Urdu speakers. Urdu is the national language of Pakistan. It's spoken in North India and Kashmir as well. Very rich language composed of Hindi, Sanskrit, Farsi, Turkish, Arabic. And the greatest poet of Urdu is Faiz Ahmed Faiz. It's unusual. His first name and last name are the same, F-A-I-Z. His most famous poem is called Bol, which in Hindi and Urdu is the imperative speak. And so when I've been to demonstrations, when I'm allowed into India and not deported, or in Pakistan or Nepal or other places in South Asia, you see these placards and they just say B-O-L, you know, in Urdu or in Hindi. And people know what that means. He was born in 1911 in Sialkot, and he died in 1984. He was also a trade unionist and proud of it. He was a journalist and proud of it, and a communist and proud of it. Fayez Ahmed Fayez. Bol, bol ke lab azad hai tere. Speak, your lips are free. Speak, your tongue is still yours. Speak, your life is still yours. Speak, there is little time, but little though it is enough time, enough before the body perishes, before the tongue atrophies. Speak, the truth still lives. Say what you have to say. Speak, your lips are free. Bol, bol, bol. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, David, for being here. And I want to touch up on the subject of corporate media coverage of climate change. In December, I was in Lima, Peru, covering United Nations Climate Change Conference for KBOO. And I wanted to point out that just three U.S.-based media organizations, of course, Democracy Now!, PR Watch, which is a
Pratap Chatterjee
branch of the Center for Media and Democracy, and KBOO, where
Bravo KBOO.
Three voices out there, you know, speaking, I mean, with critical thinking, questioning, you know, the sanity of a decision of, like, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change inviting the chief researcher of Shell to speak. Just the general, the amount of corporate presence and influence over talks. Leading up to my question is, for liberal and independent media, it's really difficult to come to events of such a scale. And probably part of that is this is a reason why only big corporate media gets all the coverage, and you know, things they say is that things like, yeah, John Kerry came today and he gave an incredible speech on how U.S. is leading combating climate change, but Secretary Kerry came in four private jets. He flew from Washington and then flew back in the same day. I mean, those are kind of things I left behind, and those are hypocritical. So can you talk about how we as an independent media are going to go about covering, let's say, Paris 2015, because those people are going to continue compromising our future, and we got to be there.
Yeah, largely, I mean, these events are staged. They're heavily scripted. They're very well organized, and there's very little space for dissidents. But where there is space, we have to be, again, creative, like the great 20th century philosopher Muhammad Ali said, you know, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. So bee, there's a beekeeper here as well. How to find those spaces, now identify the spaces and try and make wedges, try and open them, make them wider. But I think, you know, again, it's getting the word out, and the internet certainly is a tremendous source of information. It can also be a tremendous source of distraction. But, you know, again, you have to edit your time. So using those tools, the fact that we have now, just these little tape recorders. I mean, there's no tape anymore. We've all become digital recorders. You know, our phones have become instruments. They have also become cameras and have thus made citizen journalists all over the world. I mean, we're getting, you know, almost instant information. Well, then you could cynically say, yeah, we're getting the information, but nothing changes. But I think there has been a perception, at least in the United States, surrounding the issue of racism in police departments, that there's a real problem here. And it's extensive, it's endemic, and it's deeply rooted. And I think, again, imagine if we didn't have that cell phone image of Eric Garner being choked to death, you know, if it had just been a newspaper report, passive print, or the guy in L.A., the homeless guy in L.A. who was beaten to a pulp just a couple of days ago. Again, that was captured by a cell phone. So in a way, journalism is expanding in ways that are unprecedented, and it's becoming harder for, you know, people in power, police departments in this case, to cover up their crimes. On this issue of climate change, the oil and petroleum and natural gas companies are going to fight tooth and nail, because this is bottom line for them. This is about money. This is about profit. They're going to defame you. They're going to create fake science, as, you know, New York Times, to its credit, exposed recently a major climate denier scientist who's completely funded by the petrochemical oil complex, you know, to produce fake science, to inject this kind of, you know, doubt into something that should be, at this point, a slam dunk. And we shouldn't be wasting any time, you know, even talking about these kinds of issues. So they're going to fight back very hard, and they've got lots of money. They've got a political system that works, you know, mostly in their favor. You know, occasionally there are breaks in that system. But we as a people can change things. It always starts with a handful, and it grows poco a poco. That's how social change has happened historically. That's how it'll happen again. It won't come from the top. It has to come from the grassroots, from the bottom up.
Out Loud is retiring in June, but queer programming will continue on your community radio station. KBOO is proud of our longtime support of programming serving and featuring the area's queer community, and while we prepared to say goodbye to Out Loud, we welcome the opportunity for new programs to continue airing in Out Loud's time slot every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. More information is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/outloud.
Good morning. It is just 10 o'clock now, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Next up, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Air Cascadia is off for the rest of the week. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter presents a recent talk by writer and visionary Susan Griffin on the shifts in Western culture needed for addressing climate change. Thanks, all you KBOO members, for your